Okay, shall we? Now that the commercial is complete, for which I'm grateful, but yeah. We are moving along in the Midrashim on Parshat Noach. So, the title for this Midrash is Everyone Faces Judgment, and you'll see, you know, what we're talking about and why we're talking about it. There are sheets over at the end. You'll see as we play through this Midrash, it's really a spin-off of the first Midrash that we saw. The Midrash which talked about the opening sentence in the parasha saying these are the generations of Noah, and then going on to describe his righteousness as his generations. So this really comes off of the idea that Noah's righteousness and that Noah's generations are the way that he causes the world to survive and to flower. But what we're going to do is use that idea to explain verses that appear in the book of Mishlei, of Proverbs. Okay, so what we're going to have to do is start with Mishlei, start with the verses that we're talking about from Proverbs, and then from there, trace ourselves back to this Midrash. But we have to begin with the verses that they're really trying to explain, because, as we said in the very beginning of the year, not all Midrashim explain the Parsha on which they appear. This one is not about explaining Noah, it's not about explaining events from his life, although we will see events from his life through this. But we'll see it as we go through. So we begin with source number one, and the passage itself on which we are commenting, we're actually going to use verses 30 and 31 for this, but I brought you 28 and 29 because it's important to see it in context. Just have a general understanding of what Mishlei is about, what this book of Proverbs is about. It's accredited to or attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, one of three books that we attribute to him. The general view Talmudically is that Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, is what he writes in his youth about the love between God and the Jews in the form of a love poem. Then in middle age he writes Mishlei, Proverbs, which are reflections of wisdom that people are meant to benefit from. There are whole sections of it that are actually about wisdom and the pursuit of wisdom. Probably the most famous part of Mishlei, well, there are two parts that are most famous. The one part that's most famous is the last chapter, in which we get Shlomo's mother's advice to him on what sort of wife he should seek, and that's the Eshet Chayil poem, The Woman of Valor. And then the other part that's also famous, but people don't realize that it comes from Mishlei, is in Hamlet, in Polonius' speech to Laertes, like neither a borrower nor a lender be, and all that. So much of that is actually cribbed from Mishlei, from Proverbs. So, and you'll get the sense of that actually in the part that we're going to see today. So that's the book itself. And then the third one that King Solomon is credited with is Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, and he's credited with writing that at the end of his life. None of them are considered, if I remember correctly, to have been written directly in the form that we currently have them, but rather Shlomo says things that generations later in the time of King Chizkiah are collected and put together in this form, which shows when you read the books. They don't read straight. They don't read as something you can go from beginning to end with one line of thought. But that's a topic for another time. The point is that the section we have here comes from the 11th parak, the 11th chapter, in Mishlei, in Proverbs. And take a look at the sentences themselves. Boteach be'oshro hu yipol, v'che'oleh tzadikim yifrachu, ocher beso yinchal ruach, v'eved evil lachacham lev. Okay, one who trusts in his wealth will fall, but like a leaf, the righteous will flower. One who causes trouble in his house will inherit the wind, and the fool is a servant for the wise of heart. And yes, that inherit the wind thing should sound familiar, right? The Scopes trial, that the play that was made about it, right? That sounds familiar. So that line, inherit the wind, it comes from Mishlei, but it's used there talking about the fellow who's going to curse his own daughter. So he is the one who causes trouble in his house. He is the ocher beito. He will inherit the wind. So we get our pop culture as well. But the theme here is that there's the downfall of the wicked and the success of the righteous. So the person who trusts in his wealth, looking to the material, is going to fall. The righteous are going to flower. The one who causes trouble in his house will inherit the wind. The fool will end up serving the one who is wise of heart. And in general, in Mishlei, in this book, wisdom equals goodness. The assumption being, if you're going to gain wisdom, you will be good. Which is an interesting assertion, but that's the assertion. And then we continue with the two verses that our Midrash is going to try to explain. Pri tzadik eitz chayim velokeach nefashos chacham. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and one who is wise takes souls. I don't know what takes souls means yet, so you're not alone. The one who is wise takes souls. And then the last sentence, Hein tzadik ba'aretz yishulam af kirasha v'chotei. Yes, the righteous will be paid back in the land, also the wicked and the sinner. That's the passage. On a simple level, it's moral education, right? It's giving us instruction about being a good person and the fate of the good and the fate of the bad. What questions rise for you when reading this? What things here are difficult to understand? Besides the whole thing. Yeah. Ralph, welcome back.
First part and the second part don't seem to have much connection with each other.
Why?
The first part of a sentence and the second part of a sentence.
Can you give me an example here?
Well, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life.
Yeah.
And the one who is wise takes souls. I mean, what's the connection?
Right, well, it's not like the previous sentences in which we contrasted in the first half someone bad and the second half somebody good. Sentence 30 is all about the good. So that's true. But I think there may be a connection, but the simplest approach is that they're both talking about the conduct and results of the conduct of the good. Right? The fruit of the righteous person's efforts is a tree of life, and one who is wise takes souls. Still not knowing what that means. Yeah. Well, I don't. Your last two words that you just threw in there, in a good way. What does payback mean? Right. It just means get their just desserts. Whether positive or negative is not, I think, indicated by the text itself. We're going to come back to that because that's actually a linchpin of the Midrash that we're going to see. This question of what payback is. Yes.
Nowadays, we're much more concerned why good people suffer and why bad people suffer.
Nowadays. Why nowadays? They were always concerned. You find whole biblical books devoted to that question.
Yes. No, but I'm saying this seems to be the opposite kind of approach.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's very true. I don't think that's something to say very quickly. In general, when you see Mishlei, this is true. And it forms a very interesting contrast with the same author's work of Kohelet coming up later in his life. In Mishlei, in Proverbs, good people do well and prosper and have good things happen, and bad people suffer for it. And if anything, in Kohelet, it's the opposite. When he says, Hakol asher lakol kimekra ha something. I'm blanking on the rest of the sentence now. But he says, the same thing happens to everybody. The same fate meets the one who is wicked and the one who is good, the one who is wise and the one who is a fool. So you're picking up on something important here. This is assuming quite clearly that the same thing is going, that the good are going to get good things and the bad are going to get bad things. Yes, Shana.
At least the last verse suggests that it's going to happen in this world, which is, again, different from what a lot of people say.
Mm-hmm. Right. One of the classic resolutions for the problem of theodicy, of good people appearing to suffer and bad people appearing to do well, and there are many answers that are offered. Back in the Talmud itself, there are at least four different approaches that are offered. But one of the approaches is to say, well, you're only seeing part of things. You're not seeing what happens in the next world. And here, rather explicitly, we're saying, no, ba'aretz yishulam. They'll be paid back in the land, right here on earth, for their deeds. So this would appear to run counter to that that approach. Absolutely, absolutely true. So we have a few questions so far. One question is, what is this taking of souls in sentence 30? Another question is, what is what type of payback is this? Is this good payback? Is this bad payback? Ralph wants to know in general, you know, how we take sentence 30, and is this a statement? Are these two different halves, and they simply don't have to do with each other? Is one building on the other? I have another question here, really more of an underlining than a question. But in sentence 30, we say, Pri tzaddik eitz chayim. The fruit of the righteous person's deeds is a tree of life. What is a tree of life? Besides one of the two, you know, central trees in the Garden of Eden, obviously. The Torah. Okay, could be. And we certainly say, Eitz chayim hi.
This is energy to us.
Right, you can go mystical with it, right? And talk about it in terms of the chain of influences that Hashem manifests on this world, right? The and say that is the tree of life. Okay.
I just see that we started with a leaf, then we went to a flower, and then we went to a tree of life.
Very good. You see the fauna? Right? We've gone from a leaf in sentence 28, flowering like a leaf, which is an interesting idea also in sentence 28, and then now we have a full-blown tree in sentence 30. What would you do with that?
Life is like generations.
Right. Well, yeah, there's a couple of different ideas, right? One, the idea that of the tree of life and future generations coming from the righteous, and then the other, that a man, like Ora says, a human being is compared to a tree. Sharon?
But I think you could say the righteous is like a tree of life, and he takes souls, like, he attracts good souls and branches from that, because he's the tree of life, and the souls are the branches.
Mm-hmm.
People want to be with, like him, or listen to him.
Right. Ralph?
Well, in my mind, it suggests that the righteous have a positive attitude to life, and there's some sense of fulfillment out there if you work towards it.
So you're seeing that in Tree of Life because of the life idea, or is life being...
Choose life.
To choose life. Okay. Yes?
Is Namashud a linkage between the first two verses and the last two verses, and it creates a sense of progression? So
how?
You have a sense that you're going to fruition, you should pardon the expression.
Yeah. But how do you see it?
Love that the righteous progress from a relatively simple instance of belief, that they become a blossom, and ultimately they become a tree, which is larger, more steadfast, they resist more pressures, and itself becomes the source of new fruit.
Right. So I think that last point, actually, which some of you have been, I think, inclined towards also in what you said, it's the source for still more fruit. Mm-hmm. In other words, the deeds of the righteous person themselves multiply and produce other deeds. The idea of an Eitz Chayim is that it is a tree that will provide nourishment. Not to disagree with any of the other ideas. Remember that we said in the very beginning, in our very first week, there are layers upon layers to read Medrash, and that's nothing compared to the layers you will find in Tanakh. So I wouldn't reject any of the readings that I've heard. But I think this idea that it is, so to speak, the gift that keeps on giving is something we're going to see reflected in the Medrash on this. But what spurs the Medrash is, I believe, the problem of explaining the taking of souls, the question of what this payback is that the wicked and the righteous have, and also this idea of the tzaddik being with Eitz Chayim, the tree of life. Let's take a look at what happens here in source number 3, which is our Midrash. It begins again, Eileh toldot Noach, right? Words that should be familiar to us by now. These are the generations of Noah. And we know that the verse continues, Noah was righteous, right? Noah ish tzaddik. So we begin, Hahu dichsiv. This is, thus it is written. And they quote now sections from our verse. It's just section by section from verses 30 and 31. Pri tzaddik eitz chayim. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. Mahin perosav shel tzaddik. What are the fruits of the righteous? Mitzvos umasim tovim. Mitzvot and good deeds. That's the eitz chayim, the tree of life. Velokeach nefashot chacham. And one who takes souls is wise, or one who is wise takes souls. Shezon umefarnes kol yudbeis chodesh bateva. Because he fed and supported for all 12 months in the ark. So clearly we are referring to Noach. Noach is the tzaddik here. This makes sense because Noach is the only person in all of Chumash, not all Tanakh, but in all of Chumash, the five books, Noach is the only one to be described explicitly, biblically, as tzaddik. So the idea that Shlomo, when he uses the term tzaddik, is thinking Noach, is, you know, fits with that idea. And remember, in order to author Medrash like this, you have to know your Tanakh backwards and forwards. I mean, they're going to jump from Mishlei to Iyov to, you know, sometimes it looks like they're specifically finding the most exotic and esoteric verse possible to allude to a concept. So here, it is Noah we are talking about. And now, what does Lokeach Nefashot mean? Taking of lives means? Taking souls means? Supporting them. He supports them on the boat. Feeding and supporting them for all 12 months.
I'm just thinking, here, does the fruits, like the fruits of their labor, it isn't something that they're going to get, like riches or happiness, or they get mitzvahs and souls, but they get good deeds, not necessarily for themselves, but they multiply the good deeds. So I don't see like the fruits of their labors being something tangible or that you can
move with
the finger of.
Right, and I think Sharon's point is exactly what they're suggesting here, that the fruit is not the tzaddik's reward, but actually the reward of the tzaddik is the benefit to other people, to cause benefit to others. I think that's true. And it continues to say, Achar kol hashevach hazeh, after all this wonderful praise for Noach, that the his fruit is a tree of life, benefiting others, and so on. Hein tzaddik baharetz yeshulam. Yes, the righteous will be paid back in the land. Balatzeis v'nishtalem. He came to leave, meaning to leave the ark, and he was paid back. And paid back, to this medrash, means paid back in a negative way. That he's actually punished for something. He gets harmed. And so the Medrash says, Asmaha, the second time we've seen this word now. We saw it last week also. Atmaha is an expression of shock. Atma is an expression of shock. The Amar Rav Huna Mishum Rabbi Elazar Benosh Rabbi Yossi Aglili, as Rav Huna said, quoting Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Noach Kishaya Yotzeimen HaTeva, He Kisho Ari Vishibro. When Noach was leaving the boat, the lion bit him and broke his bones. V'lo haya kasher lahakriv, and Noach was unsuited to bring offerings to God. He was a bal mum. He now had a physical blemish, which disqualifies him from serving as a kohen, as a priest. Granted that the Torah has not been given, this is entirely anachronistic. But the concept of it is that one who is incomplete cannot serve. I want to come back to that in a moment. But and therefore v'hikriv shame b'no tachtav, and so his son Shame brought offerings in his place. Now, the idea that if one is physically incomplete, one is unsuited to serve, is one that we have a very hard time with in our day. We are more suited to saying, ignore the physical, look to who the person really is, don't get distracted by the material. The classic explanation for why a Kohen who was incomplete looking, was unable to serve, was that it's a concession to human nature, a recognition of human nature, which is that even though I know that I am supposed to look past the physical, the reality is that if I walk into my synagogue and I see something in the decor that is inadequate, if I see something that looks like it was cobbled together or like they stinted on something, then instinctively, on some level, it leads me to think, well, this really isn't worth respecting, or they don't treat it with respect. Similarly, the Kohen who is serving, if we put up a Kohen who looks like he is lacking, then instinctively for us, that triggers some kind of sense of this isn't as worthy. This is a response to that instinct within a human being, even though we fully recognize that it's not a good instinct to have. Now, you could make the argument back, and I imagine that some of us will, then say, well, you should be trying to teach people instead of catering to their worst instincts. You know, by saying that the person who is who looks defective now can't serve, you're now accepting what we believe is fundamentally a wrong idea. We are taught al tistakel b'kankan ela b'mashayeshbo, don't look at the bottle, look at what's inside, right? Don't judge a book by its cover and so on. Why are you now playing along with it? It's a good question. But that's the core concept. Without this becoming a shiur about balei mum, about blemished kohanim, there is a radical idea out there from someone from the Gush. I'm forgetting now who it was who put forth this idea. My instinct is to say Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, because it's the sort of thing that he would say, but I'm not sure. That actually suggested that in the time of the Third Temple, then the rules of blemishes will be thrown out the window. In other words, it's something meant for an earlier time, not meant for the future Beis HaMikdash. But I don't know.
This is very different than the Passover story. We always learn that in the Haggadah, Moshe's name is not mentioned. But we always, the emphasis is on that Hashem took the people out. And here Noah's getting the credit and not Hashem.
Well, there's a big difference, no? What kind of work does Moshe have to do to get the Jews out of Egypt? It takes courage, but he didn't have to do any labor.
No.
Right? It's not as though Moshe himself is lifting frogs out of the river, you know, to go cast them into Egypt. Noach, and we're going to see it spelled out more in another source later on, Noach is spending all day long for a year running around taking care of the animals. He deserves some credit.
But he doesn't say to everybody, you know, he has a whole year to tell the whole world to come on.
Well, he has 120 years to tell everybody that. And who's to say he didn't try? There is a Medrash that says he didn't try, but we haven't seen that yet. So we'll have to discuss that when we get there. God willing, we get there. We'll see. But it's a worthwhile question. Sharon?
Well, I'm just thinking along this line that maybe this is what God's way of retiring.
Mm-hmm. With a lion. There are less painful ways, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot here. I'm going to try to look into some of this imagery of Noah getting bitten and the offering. We're going to see some of this.
I wonder if he had to get drunk.
Yeah, it was anesthesia. So Noah is paid back. We don't know what he's being paid back for either, right? Right now, all we know is Noah is bitten by a lion on his way out of the boat. And so his son Shem takes his place, and then the Midrash concludes. Kal v'chomer af ki rasha v'chote. Kal v'chomer is an expression used for a logical deduction. In this case, we're going to say, if Noah, who was so good, got zapped for something, how much more so the sinner, the wicked one and the sinner, Zed Doramabel, and that's a reference to the generation of the flood, that certainly they will be punished. So what this is trying to do is to link the passages in Mishle with Noach as a way to explain the passages themselves. The idea is, going back to source number one, we talked about in sentence 29, the one who causes trouble in his household is going to inherit the wind. We contrast that with Noach. Noach is the one who saved his household. Right? Noach's family is saved because of Noach. So Noach is the opposite, and he's in sentence 30. The pre-tzaddik, the fruit of this righteous one of Noach, is a tree of life because Noach saves the world. it is the gift that keeps on giving. The benefit of Noach's righteousness is that all the animals are saved here, and that Noach's family is saved, and these are his toladot. These are his descendants. His righteousness is what descends from him. That's the idea. And then the taking of the souls, that's Noach's support for the animals on the boat. And this payback is actually a negative. It's actually punishment. This now takes us back to Chana's point about the fauna imagery in general. We find throughout Tanakh, or mentioned one source, that the tree, the righteous person, is compared to the tree, and the tree particularly benefits others. If you remember, those who were with us for Daniel last year, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in which he saw himself represented as a tree with great leaves and branches and fruit, taking care of the entire population. The image of the king as the tree taking care of everybody. In Shoftim, in Judges chapter 9, I think, the Mashal HaIlanot, the parable of the trees, in which the trees go looking for a king, and they go to the grape and say, will you rule over us? And they go to the fig, will you rule over us? And the olive, and so on. And each one has a reason not to rule, and that's a story in its own right. But the point is that the tree is the provider. Right? Think of the classic Gemara in Ta'anis, which gets quoted in Nice Divrei Torah usually at weddings or at bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, where one of the sages benefits from a tree, and he enjoys the stream, and he sits in the shade and he eats the fruit, and then he says, tree, how am I going to bless you? Right? Ilan ilan bama avarechacha, what blessing can I give you? And it was made into a song also. There was a song. So how am I going to bless you? And he blesses him that all those that come from this tree should be like this tree. All of the saplings that are produced. But the idea is that the tree is indeed one's support for others, and that's what's seen in this tzaddik. So the simple read that we have of this medrash is: Noach is righteous. Noach provides for others. Noach gets bitten when he's leaving the boat. He gets zapped. And the idea is that the righteous are indeed good. They indeed provide for others. But they're going to have to pay for whatever wrongdoing they do. And certainly the wicked are going to have to pay. That's the simple and straightforward read. It only took us half an hour. But the problem that I have is that this medrash leaves me with two questions of very different kinds. One is a question of text, and the other is a question of storyline. As a matter of text, you're telling me that the word Yishulam in Mishlei, in Proverbs 11:31, the word paid back, is a negative. Who told you that it was a negative? It could be a positive, to be paid back with reward. And maybe the statement is that the righteous will get their reward for their good deeds. And certainly the wicked, if they did something good, they're also going to get rewarded for their good deeds. Who says this has to be a negative? That's one question. And then a second question is storyline. What's the story with this lion thing? What did Noah do to deserve getting bitten by a lion? Where did this come from? It's certainly not found in any clear way in Parshat Noah. And this idea of him not being able to bring the offering, and Noah and Shem, his son, bringing the offering, where did this materialize from? So let's see if we can tackle those questions. So first of all, Yishulam being about punishment. In truth, take a look at source number 4. It doesn't have to be about punishment. Rabbi Avram ibn Ezra, writing in the 11th century, in his commentary to the book of Mishlei, actually reads it as a positive, as reward, not as a negative. That's okay. He's not terribly bothered by the Medrash. He reads it, Ba'aretz Yishulam will be paid back in the land. Ba'odo chai Yishalem lo Hashem ma'aseh hatov. While the righteous person is still alive, God will pay him for his good deeds. Af, also, Kimochein harishaim yishulam schar peulasam terem mosam, that the wicked will also be paid back for their deeds, sounds like their good deeds, before they die. In other words, it's entirely possible to read this as a positive. And in that sense, it's a statement of encouragement. It's saying, look, even if you've been wicked, do good deeds, because the righteous person is rewarded and you'll get rewarded also. That's one way to take this. You could actually read Ibn Ezra to be in the negative for the wicked person, but I don't get the sense that that's what he means. But the point is that everybody gets a positive reward. You could read this sentence that way and ignore our Midrash. However, our Midrash doesn't do that. Our Midrash takes it as a negative. So the question still is, why? What's the fuel for this negative read? So I did a little searching, made easier by the wonderful tool called the Bar Ilan CD-ROM, to find out where the word Yishulam shows up in Tanakh. And lo and behold, the word Yishulam, with this format, not Yishalem, to pay, but Yishulam, to be paid back, has three other appearances in Tanakh. And I brought them for you on your sheet. Source number 5. Is the first time it appears in Yirmiyahu in Jeremiah. It's a question that he asks regarding his own fate. Remember that Yirmiyahu suffers miserably at the hands of the Jews he is meant to teach. Right? When he's not being thrown in a pit, he's being put in chains. The king wants to kill him. Yirmiyahu suffers miserably throughout his time as a prophet. So at one point he turns to God and says, in source 5, Hayishulam tachas tova ra'a ki charushu chalanashi. Will good be repaid with bad? For they have dug a pit for my life. That's his statement. In other words, they're trying to throw me into a pit. They want to kill me. Yishulam here is to be paid back positively or negatively? Negative, right? It's a negative payback. Okay, flip the sheet. This comes from our own work, Mishlei, Proverbs. Baz ledavar yechavel lo vire mitzvah hu yishulam. One who scorns the message will be damaged by it. One who reveres the command will be rewarded. Positive. Right, Yishulam is a positive, to be paid back positively. If you revere God's command, you will be rewarded. So that's for the good. And then you have in source number 7, one that I brought here only for the sake of completeness, but it's actually a different usage altogether. It's Yishulam, ulecha Yishulam neder, saying to God, to you the vow will be fulfilled, it will be paid. What it's pointing to, I brought it here so that the set would be complete, but it's pointing to the fact that the word Yishulam can have two different roots, which are related. One is shalem, to be whole, to be made whole. The other is to pay for something, like tashlum, exactly. So the one here, yishulam neder, is really that the vow will be made whole. Unlike the cases that we've been dealing with, which are to be payback for something. So it's not quite the same as the others, but I brought it in any case. The point is, Yishulam can be positive, Yishulam can be negative. So let's flip back to the first side, please. Look again back at source number 1, sentence 31. Hein sadik baaretz yishulam af ki rasha b'chotei. The righteous will be paid back in the land, also the wicked and the sinner. If I have a choice of reading it positively or negatively, which we've now seen I do have, because I've got the word used in positive and negative contexts, what am I inclined to do more, positive or negative, in this context? What makes more sense in the context? Sorry, wait a second. I've heard three different things. Each one gets what he deserves. So positive for one, negative for the other. Alina, you were going to say?
Well, I would say negative because when it's used for also, if it's a wicked and sinner, you can
make
it negative. So
okay, so in other words, making it consistent the whole way through, negative because that's what the person who is wicked would be getting B. Yes. What are my choices in translating off? I'm sorry?
But get what they deserve, which is
Right. But does af mean but? I think af in general is not a subjunctive, right? Af is usually adding. It's also. Right.
Even more so.
Yeah. It would tend to be the translation of af. But I think you're right. I think it all hinges on how I'm going to take the word af. And taking it as also, or all the more so, it would seem that Yerushalayim should be negative. The righteous will be paid back in the land, all the more so the wicked. Well, then it makes sense to say that it's talking about negative payback. Because all the more so, one who has done something bad is going to get punished. Shana.
But this is coming back to the idea that there's no reward for this side in this world. Yeah. That's what he does, and he receives nothing for it in this world.
In other words, it's an interesting idea. Once I've said that in sentence 30, the fruit of the righteous doesn't refer to a reward they're getting, but rather the results of their deeds are a tree of life. And I've taken 31 and said he's being punished for his misdeeds, right? So now I have not stated that positive reward for your good deeds shows up in this world. Okay. There's a Gemara in Brachos that would make that problematic, because there they actually say that they insist that both are the next world, not this. In other words, the way they frame it there is actually the righteous person is punished in this world so that he'll have only his good deeds to be rewarded in the next, and the wicked person is rewarded for good deeds in this world so that he'll have his punishment in the next. So we got half here. But it's an interesting point. In other words, now what we've said is that reward is all next worldly. Okay. But what we drew out of here, again, I want to do the things that are a little more challenging, but I also want to make sure that we're clear on what we've accomplished. Is suggested a reason why I would read this as a negative here. I have the option of reading Yerushalayim as negative from ways it appears elsewhere in Tanakh. That's number one. And number two, the righteous person is going to be paid back negatively in the land, how much more so the wicked and the sinner. It makes the sentence flow well. So that could be what's driving the Medrash in seeing this as referring to some kind of punishment. It's a reference to Noach and how Noach got zapped. But that brings me to my next question, which is, how did Noach get zapped? Where did you get this from? It's all well and good to say there's a sentence about a tzaddik getting hurt. But to just transplant it to Noah's life and to make the lion the villain, I'm missing a step. So when did this happen to Noah? Take a look on your sheet, second side. Yes. I don't know. Yeah, that's the lioness.
It could be because he's stripped up, right?
But a lion is a metaphor.
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about with a lion yet. Yes.
If you look in the Tanakh, Hashem tells Noah to enter the ark a certain order.
Yes.
And he tells him to exit the ark in a different order. But he doesn't. So I'm thinking that even though he was a tzaddik, he still can make a mistake, still didn't listen to Hashem.
Interesting. When he tells Noah to leave, he says, Tzemen ha-teva, atavi ishtecha
u'shnei. His wife should come before his sons.
Yeah, you, your wife, and your sons, yeah.
And he doesn't do it.
What does he do?
He
it's a Noach uvanav v'ishto. Right.
It's a different world now.
Right.
It's a different...
Interesting.
Yeah.
What I would have liked would have been if he came out last, because he's limping from this lion.
It's a metaphor in that he doesn't want to
be shalem.
Yeah. Okay, could be. Let's see what the Medrash does with it. I claim no limits on understanding this. But take a look at source number 8. A sentence describing the demolition of the planet, the rolling back of Bereshis. Right, that's what the Mabul, what the flood fundamentally is. It's a rolling back of creation, best spelled out in this sentence right here. Vayimach es kol hayekum asher al pnei ha'adamah. He destroyed all that lived Yikum is a hard word to translate, but it's from Kuf Mem, to stand, to rise. He destroyed all that had lived upon the face of the land. Me Adam, from man, day 6 of creation. Ad Behema, to the beast, day 5 of creation. Ad Remes Varov HaShamayim, the crawling creature and bird of the heavens, day 3 of creation. Vayimachum in Haaretz, it all was wiped off the land. Vayisha'er Ach Noach. And only Noah and those with him in the boat remained. So if I were to read this as Mordechai Tochina reading a sentence, I would say, okay, so it describes that it's just Noah and those on the boat that remain. But the sages, when they are looking at this through the Midrashic lens, are once again studying language, and they catch a word. And the word that's extra in this sentence is... what word is extra in the Hebrew? Or in the English? No, destroyed you need to say. The point is that it was destroyed. Ach. The word ach in the Hebrew, only in the English. You could have said, and Noach and those with him in the boat remained. Again, this wouldn't have bothered me terribly. But ach is a code word. Talmudically, you find that the word ach is used to teach important lessons. For example, we say that on Erev Pesach, the day before Passover, you're supposed to destroy your chametz. And the Torah says, ach bayom harishon tashbitu sormi batechem, only on the 14th, on the first day, which we understand to mean the day before Pesach, you shall destroy the chametz from your homes. And we take the word only there to mean that it's actually at midday that you have to destroy it. It's not any time on the 14th, but specifically by noon on the 14th of Nisan, which is a time that we change a little bit rabbinically for reasons beyond the scope of this class. But the point is that the word ach is taken as a limiting word. Not everything, only part. That's how we understand the word ach. It's what we call a mi'ut. It's an exclusion. It's excluding something. So only Noach, to the exclusion of what? It's not to the exclusion of all the things that were destroyed. We already know about those. The answer is, part of Noach is excluded. That's what the Medrash is suggesting. It's that Noach, but not all of Noach. Some of Noach didn't make it. What in the world is that about? Well, take a look at source number 9. And we find out what happens to Noah. Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi said, Kol shnemas ar chodesh shahaya Noach bateva. All 12 months that Noah was in the boat. Lo tam tam shena. He didn't taste the taste of sleep. He didn't sleep at all. It's really, I didn't do it justice when I translated it as he did not sleep. It's meant to be stronger. He did not taste sleep. Lo hu v'lo banav, neither him nor his kids. Shahayu zikukin lizon es habehema v'hachaya, they needed to feed the beasts. And actually, when you look in the original version in the Medrash, they talk about the elephant needs this kind of food, and the donkey needs this kind of food, and you have to take care of all the different animals. Rabbi Yochanan Amar b'shem Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Rabbi Yochanan said, quoting Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, whom we already saw, by the way, quoted in source number 3, with a separate statement about Noach. But what he says is, Pam achas shah Noach lizones ha'ari. Noach once delayed feeding the lion. If you have to choose which one you're going to be late for, it's not the lion. V'kisho ha'ari, v'yatza soleya. The lion bit him and he left the boat limping. He wasn't laughing. Shenamar, as the pasuk says, v'yishaer ach Noach. As it says, only Noach remained. Some part of Noach did not remain. And that's the idea. So Noach... Noach is being zapped here, and the Medrash is offering an explanation which highlights the extreme demand on him, and yet he's punished for this minor offense. Yes?
Is the lion just a symbolic term here? It's not the real lion.
So Hannah suggested maybe it's a metaphorical lion. The problem is, does he have a metaphorical band-aid to put on the wound that he got from the metaphorical lion? I have a hard time understanding this in general. It's a sort of story which I would look at and say, well, gee, why didn't that make it into the Torah's text explicitly? Why did this need to be hinted? What is going on here? To which the answer would be something which I said in an earlier week, which is that the written Torah is meant to be passed down with the explanations, and therefore it's meant to be taught with this side by side. But it's certainly an interesting story. Yes?
Also, Sean, got rid of all the evil people and were
That's a good point. It also highlights the wild character of the animals. You shouldn't assume that everybody on the boat is good. The lion, I mean, yeah, at the end of a year in a boat, you can get kvetchy. You know, it's not. It's the lion has something of an excuse, you know, to justify his conduct. But that's the idea here. And what happens now is that Noah is not able to bring the offering to God. Now, you'll say, well, this is unfair. So actually, take a look at... before I get to that, take a look first at source number 10. Here, we find out about Noah bringing the offerings to God when he gets out of the boat. Vayiven Noach mizbeach l'Hashem. Noach built an altar for God. Vayikach, and he took mikol ha-behema tahora, mikol ha-ofa tahor, from all of the kosher species. Vayal olot ba-mizbeach, and he brought burnt offerings on the altar. Did you notice that his name appeared in the beginning of the sentence and didn't appear at the end? It used a pronoun. Now, as I mentioned last week, the Torah loves pronouns. And often it's vague in terms of, well, who is being referred to in a particular pronoun. But I think the Medrash is picking up on that and suggesting Noah builds the altar, but he doesn't get to bring the offerings. Someone else is bringing the offerings. Who's bringing the offerings? Oh, Shem is bringing the offerings. Well, that's actually a really interesting thing, the idea that Shem is bringing the offerings. Why is that of particular interest? No, but that Shem is the one in particular. Who is Shem elsewhere in the Torah? Who does Shem get recycled as? Anybody know? Malki Tzedek, Melech Shalem, Vehu Chohen Lekel Elyon. In the story of the war between four kings and five kings, in which Lot is captured, and Abraham, being a good brother-in-law, goes to bail him out, after Abraham has defeated these vicious kings, along comes Malki Tzedek. Literally, my king is just, or my king is righteous, or my king is righteousness, who is described as being the king of Shalem, the king of this place called Shalem, complete, which we associate with Ur Shalem, or Yerushalayim, king of Jerusalem. And he is described as being Kohen Lekel Elyon, a priest for God above. Says the Medrash, who is this person who just materializes in the book of Bereshit out of nowhere? We don't know anything about him before. We don't know anything about him afterwards. I believe in the Christian Apocrypha, they actually try to make a lot out of Malki Tzedek. But in our texts, we don't know anything about him. How can someone just materialize in the middle of the book of Bereshit as this righteous priest of God, and I don't know anything about who this is? So the Medrash says, law of conservation of biblical personalities, don't worry, we have people who show up multiple times by multiple names. Malki Tzedek is actually Shem. Which feeds into the idea that later on in Sefer Bereshit, Tamar is going to be the daughter of Shem, and he is a Kohen, which fits into the story of Yehuda and Tamar in ways that I'm not going to confuse us with right now. But also, it fits. Malki Tzedek is Shem. Malki Tzedek is described as a Kohen. Shem is a Kohen. When was he a Kohen? When he brought the offerings in place of his father. So what we're seeing here, and this is what I really wanted to draw from this, not so much the individual lesson about Shem and Malki Tzedek and Tamar and Kohanim, but the ways in which Midrashim weave together. It isn't enough for the author of a Midrash to be well-versed in Tanakh. The author of the Midrash is also well-versed in other Midrashim and weaves them back and forth. So that when I look at the sentence in Mishle and say, well, where was Noach paid back? Oh, well, that fits in really well with this idea of Vayishaer Ach Noach, only Noach remained, that he got bitten. And then that fits with this idea that Noach wasn't actually the one who brought the offerings, but Shem, his son, was the Kohen who brought the offerings. Well, why didn't Noach bring the offerings? Because he couldn't bring the offerings, because he got bit with the lion. Because of Ach Noach, he got paid back with Yeshulam. They all tie, the Midrashim all interweave with each other. If a person hears a Midrash in a vacuum quite often, they'll come away with a sense of, there's got to be more here. And there is. but you have to learn the other midrashim in order to catch what else is going on. And for that matter, to go back to our metaphorical or non-metaphorical lion, I would wager that if I knew more about Medrash, I would be able to also offer you some connection from this lion to something else regarding lions and biting and a punishment for them eventually for biting Noah and so on. Yes?
Is there a reason why Noah's son was supposed to do the offering and therefore Noah was under this blemish so that his son could do it?
That's a really interesting question Rita asks. Do we have to assume that this is a punishment of Noah for showing up late? Or perhaps it's because of something completely different in the storyline, such as Shem is supposed to become a Kohen. If Shem has to be a Kohen, then he's got to get bumped out of the way. Noah has to be bumped out of the way. How's that going to happen? Oh, let's bring along a lion. That's a good way to bump someone off. I'm not joking when I say that. I mean glib, but I'm not joking. But I think that there's something to be said for that, because there is another medrash, which I did not bring here in an attempt to minimize the confusion, but there is another medrash which actually quotes this business about Noah being bitten in relation to the verse that I referenced before in Kohelet, in Ecclesiastes, in which Shlomo says, the same fate meets the wicked and the good, the righteous and so on. Hakol kasher lakol mekre achad letzadik v'la rasha. When it says, yeah, everybody meets the same fate, it quotes this as an example. It says, Noach is tzadik, Noach is righteous, and yet he gets bitten. See that? The same thing happens to everybody. So they're taking your view, in fact, that it may not have been punishment for him at all. Within explaining Mishlei, it is punishment. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. And it's, in a vacuum.
And also the lion is like the king of the forest, or, the leader. So there is some metaphorical symbol with the lion. Why the lion? Well, we didn't beat the lion, but still. Why did we beat the lion? Because the lion is so important in the jungle. Like, it's, very interesting. There is a kind of a metaphor there.
I think there's for sure room to explore more. So again, what we have is sentences in Proverbs that in Mishlei that talk about the fruit of the righteous being a tree of life, taking souls, payback for the righteous and the wicked. In order to explain this, we associate it with the tzaddik, who is Noah, who takes souls in the sense that he supports them, whose good deeds are a tree of life, supporting others, and who indeed is paid back with this biting that he experiences on the boat, paid back in a negative way, like the use of paid back in Yirmiyahu, paid back in a negative way, which may have been punishment to him for delaying in feeding the lion, or may simply have been, this is life, but it leads to his son Shem becoming the priest, becoming the Kohen, and he will show up later in Bereshit as the Kohen. That wasn't so complicated. We got that all in one paragraph. The one last bit, though, this idea of the righteous person suffering, even though, really it seems like he did everything he possibly could, shows up elsewhere in Talmud. If you take a look at source number 11, I give you one example. The Talmud alleges that a gentleman by the name of Nakdimon Ben Gurion from the time of the Second Temple was not philanthropic enough. Or not philanthropic, is actually the contention. And the Talmud then challenges that statement and says, V'nagdimon ben-Gurion lo avat tzedakah. Nagdimon ben-Gurion didn't give tzedakah. He wasn't philanthropic. What do you mean? V'atanya, I have the following lesson that I've learned. Amru alav al Nagdimon ben-Gurion, k'shayotim yibesel lebes ha-medrash klemila sayumatziyim tachtav. When Nagdimon would leave his house to go to the study hall, they would spread silks beneath him. U'bananim u'makaplanosan me'acharav. And as he passed, the people who were indigent would come along and they would collect these and take them, and then they would presumably sell them and use it for their support. So Nagdimon is incredibly philanthropic. Every time he leaves the house to go to the study hall, he's giving tzedakah to the people in need. So Ibayis Ema, the Talmud has two answers here. The first answer is Lichvodo Huda Avad. Yeah, but he did it for his own honor. In other words, it made him look good. That's one approach. This was a little too public for our comfort. That's one approach. Poor Nagdimon getting slandered this way. But then the second explanation, if you want, I'll tell you. Yes, he was philanthropic, but he didn't do what he could have done. With his wealth, he should have given away more than just these silks. Like people say, according to the camel, the burden. You don't put a big burden on a weak camel. But if you have a camel that can carry a lot, then you give the camel a greater burden. So he could have done more. And that's what I brought this passage for, was to say, maybe the answer is, Noach on his level is getting punished for not being up to the task. And I brought you source number 12, the classic way that this is phrased in the Talmud. It's actually an analysis of a biblical verse, but I didn't want to get too far afield with it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu medagdeg im sivivav kechut hasara. God is precise with his surroundings to the width of a hair. If you want to be around God, you have to know that he is a very, very demanding God. And he's going to demand that you be tip-top. And that's where Noah will end up suffering. Ultimately, just to wrap up, the moral of the story here, what we're meant to learn from this medrash, as I understand it, is that even the righteous person is going to be repaid for his sins. And therefore, we are supposed to take a lesson from it. We've seen how wonderful Noach is and the good things that he gets. But we have to recognize that even the righteous person is going to be repaid for his sins. That's, so to speak, moral of the story. Hence the title I gave it, Everyone Faces Judgment. And from a standpoint of technique, the way that we parse a word, like the word Yishulam, to say it as negative payback, depends on how it's used elsewhere in Tanakh, as well as the context in which it appears. And you have to be very precise when you look at wording. That's the key. We've said it over and over again. It's all about the study of language. So taking a word like Yishulam, or taking a word like Ach, and saying, well, what is this meant to teach me? That's the bread and butter of Medrash. Sharon and then... Yeah. Like a video game. You know, you get up, you finish the level, and you have to go to the next level. Not to trivialize anything. Yes, agreed.